Again, thank you for your practice. Nice to sit with you. I found a fair degree of enjoyment in hearing the birds outside and also the cars going by, which reminded me during the meditation period that our way of relating to phenomena is really what generates our level of well-being, our absence of it, because the noise of the cars going by is often perceived as an annoyance or a distraction. And during the meditation, I used the word contact, allowing awareness to make contact with sensory phenomena. And when that alone happens, there's often a sense of spaciousness or even enjoyment that arises in relationship to our environment. And we can see that in the context of the mundane. I wanted to say a few things tonight about clear seeing or seeing clearly. This is a term or phrase, of course, that will be familiar to anyone who has come around for some time to Dharma centers or Dharma practice or Dharma communities. Simply said, Dharma practice is something we do in order to see more clearly. And the type of seeing being referred to in the context of Dhamma can be understood specifically as seeing that frees, seeing that fosters liberation. So this really gets at the heart of the Buddha Dhamma. Most likely, if we are practicing with an accurate sense of the Dhamma, we wish to be more free, right? Or we wish maybe to sustain the level of freedom that we have currently. In most cases, however, I would argue that even the most seasoned practitioners can afford to experience more insight and to be more free. There's stories, ancient stories in the Pali Canon, where very devoted practitioners would have considerably high level insights, and their teachers, in some cases the Buddha, would at that point almost encourage them to practice more. You know, seeing that a threshold had been reached, and therefore the person had a capacity to become even more wise. I've seen a lot in our culture, people having entry level and moderate level insights and applauding themselves on the back and relaxing their effort around practice. Very different culture, very different time that we live in. So the Dhamma is developmental. It grows upon itself in a sense. I think of it like I do craft traditions, such as woodworking or stone masonry, for example. Or perhaps similar to the development of an artist. Through Dhamma practice, we gradually learn to live more artfully. Though in the Dhamma world, we usually say that we are learning to become more skillful. Learning to become more skillful. Isn't that also true, however, of an artist or a craftsperson? They are developing skill, refining a set of techniques. Refining a set of techniques. Perhaps the illusion of mastery, both in the craft tradition and in the contemplative traditions, lend themselves to certain people thinking they've figured it out. In a sense, this threatens to compromise the notion of journey or path that might in many cases be necessary to sustain real awakening. We want to be free in order to achieve a very high level of happiness and to enjoy our lives at the highest level possible. A level that perhaps we don't even quite understand prior to the attainment of certain insights. And we want to be free in order to live with a natural ease that is innate within us but often obscured. Seeing clearly is what makes the Dhamma both more real and more accurate than the conceived impression we have of it. Seeing clearly is what makes the Dhamma both more real and more accurate than the conceived impression we have of it. Seeing clearly brings us closer to an authentic Dhamma as we gradually move further away from a conceptual relationship to the Dhamma. In this sense, seeing clearly is experiential. Seeing clearly is not a new set of ideas, but rather it is synonymous with direct experience. And again, any of us who have come around for some time have heard innumerable times references to direct experience. We've also probably heard the notion of knowing being tossed around. Knowing in the context of Dhamma is not thinking differently. In fact, it is not thinking at all, but rather it is experiencing, right? This is the difference between the way we use the word knowing in a Buddhist context and the definitions we find in an English dictionary. Right? Knowing is experiencing in the context of Dhamma. Specifically, it is a type of, I would say, raw experience beyond our manipulation or the filters of perceptual habit. It may include the facet of mind that thinks, but it is not limited to nor reliant upon it. Direct comprehension is pre-thought and is more often than not disrupted by thought. Thinking is that which will end knowing, at least temporarily. Thinking can be the phenomena that ends clear seeing. Clear comprehension becomes tinged, if you will, by preferences and our conditioning. So when we are free, we are content and fulfilled. Or when we are more free, we are more content and more fulfilled. In the part of the mind that is looking for more, trying to extract something else from life, has ceased to turn its engines. And we can feel that directly, experientially. It's almost as if something has been turned off, right? Just like, you know, imagine hearing the motor of something like a car or a generator or a lawnmower, right? If your hands are on the lawnmower, you can feel the vibration. It's very palpable and you can hear it, right? And then that lawnmower runs out of gas or you choose to turn it off. There's a change, right? There's a shift experientially. there's a similar shift happens when we're not in a tug of war with life. We're not trying to get anything from it. We're not trying to get rid of anything. Something settles. So we feel both at ease and free. We're not working so hard at becoming something other than we are, or changing the circumstances of our lives. Rather, we are okay as we are. We are okay where we are. We understand that what is sought most deeply is to be found only in the present moment, moments met without the polarizing mental activities of wanting and not wanting. This is not stress reduction. It is a moment in time beyond stress. Thinking about the Dhamma easily becomes very tricky, whereas experiencing the Dhamma is very simple. Actually, probably one of life's most simple things, even though not everybody will experience it. As I mentioned earlier, just briefly, recently, my friend and I went to Newfoundland with the goal of riding our bikes off-road about 600 miles through the remote countryside from the east coast of the island to the west coast. And the first 2 days were extremely hard. Perhaps some of the hardest days on a bike for me. And I think there were two reasons for this. One reason was because in coming to the adventure from daily life, my mind was a bit rigid, okay? In this case, I noticed that my mind was very aversive and specifically resistant to the difficulty caused by the terrain that was unexpectedly difficult. What occurred was the trail in many places had large gravel stones that were, let's say, between 2 and 4 inches deep, depending on the location. That might not sound like a big deal, but what happens in situations like this is when you press the pedals, instead of the bike being propelled forward, the top layers of stone spin on the layers beneath it. Thus you work very hard for very little forward progress, right? Often we were traveling at about half the anticipated pace, and over a long tour, that could have a variety of consequences, including not, making the ferry back to the mainland and, getting back to your family in time or your responsibilities, your job. I think I can speak for both of us, but my account here is in reference to my own experience. We were suffering physically because we were not acclimated to the terrain and because we were working so hard. However, on top of this, we had to ride between 65 and 85 miles per day just to find a place to sleep and get potable water. So there was there are these various factors that accumulated to create a particular kind of fatigue. My mind was focused on the physical pain, on the suffering. That was the predominant experience. And of course, this also meant that I was suffering mentally as well, right? Admittedly, it was hard to find joy at first in the experience. In talking about this later with my friend, and talking about it often throughout the course of the trip, in fact, this trip for both of us became a kind of rumination on the relationship between cycling, the quality of mind, and from that, trying to read into other important life matters, right? In talking about this with my friend, we both acknowledged that we were a bit concerned about the prospect of 600 miles under those conditions. And it was not so much that we were concerned about the gravel or the pace, but how we might relate, I think, to our own decision to take 3 weeks out of our lives, travel to a different country, and not find joy or not find the type of deep introspective insight that expeditionary travel can offer. I think we were deeply humbled and very, very quickly. During these first few days, I did not notice very much about the landscape. I hardly noticed anything beyond the handlebars of my own bike. I didn't really see much beyond the narrow trail, the gravel beneath my tires. It was a little bit like being in a tunnel of dukkha, a tunnel of suffering. Even though I was riding through a beautiful, natural, and wild landscape. And the main focus was myself, which is to say I was completely self-absorbed. And this is something as meditators we come to understand about the nature of suffering, right? From a Dhamma perspective, I was seeing a lot of selfing, a near constant proliferation of self and suffering, in the total absence of freedom, right? As time went on, the body adapted. This happens quite quickly. But equally important, I saw what I was doing. My practice kicked in eventually, somewhere around day four. I began to relate to pain as sensation, simply as sensation. And as soon as I did that, I began to notice both pleasant sensations and unpleasant sensations, whereas previously I had only noticed unpleasant sensations. Now, the truth is, pleasant sensations were happening all along, but because of the way I was relating to my experience, it became one-dimensional, right? And I was able to unhook, at first only occasionally, I was able to unhook from the erroneous view that all I was experiencing was suffering. So there was a kind of progression underway. With time, as the suffering decreased, as the physical suffering decreased, I began to widen my attention. I wasn't in a mode of self-preservation, and because of that, I could expand the attentional field. In fact, I started to do this, fortunately, fairly quickly, intentionally, as a strategy to deal with physical pain. I reminded myself to look to the left and look to the right rather than only in front of me. So what happened was I began to see the landscape. Endless water views at the ocean edge, hundreds of yards below steep cliffs and miles across the horizon. Once leaving the coast, they were endless, literally endless rivers and lakes. And I truly started to become struck by the beauty, literally amazed at the way a near untouched landscape had grown so splendidly. There were springtime flowers in full bloom, sometimes as far as the eye could see. I had at one point the thought, and more than once, the thought that no landscape designer or landscape architect could ever create such a sight, nor a human experience. One must truly go to wild places to see what I was seeing. In the best of moments, as the days progressed and I moved in time and mental space further away from home, further away from work, further away from towns and villages, further away from Wi-Fi, there was a simultaneous dissolving of the self, not unlike sitting meditation retreat. Specifically, I was noticing that I was only occasionally resistant to unpleasant experience. Of course, this raises the question about the nature of pain, about the nature of unpleasant, and as we know, about the nature of the self, the entity or thing that experiences pain, that experiences mental suffering. There was often simply an ever-changing parade of sensory phenomena, sensations, pleasant and unpleasant, sights, sounds, smells, and the flickering of the mind, but with each day, less thinking, less self-reference. I could say that things were happening, but not so much to me, not so much to I, right? There was less a distinct self to which things were happening, in more a kind of meshing or merging of awareness and sensory phenomena. Right? At the best of times, there was simply awareness in the sensory world touching that awareness, a very basic sense of contact. So, there are two ways of thinking about seeing clearly. And there might be more than two ways, but there are at least two ways of thinking about seeing clearly. And this, I think, is pretty obvious. One, seeing more accurately. And two, seeing more rather than less, right? And in some sense, the brief example of moving across the landscape on a bike encapsulates both of those. In simple terms, seeing more accurately is to see the world without self-reference. This is a considerably profound and deep insight from a Buddhist perspective, to see the not-self nature of experience. Things are happening, but not to us. Right? Things are always happening, right? Phenomena is always rising and passing away. Seeing more rather than less is to see beyond the limited gaze of the self caught in the snare of self-afflicted suffering. To see beyond self-reference. We could argue, therefore, to see the Dhamma, to see the way things are, to see the truth. Right? And this is what facilitates real freedom. This is seeing clearly. So in closing, every day, at the expense of turning this to something trivial or cliched, every day there are truths we don't see. Every day there is the prospect of presence and significant fulfillment. And sometimes we see that when suffering is the most acute. The point being that when suffering is acute, the self is very involved. Right? So the proximity to freedom is right there. Yet it feels like we're miles from it. It is not through some special geographic location that we find this, but simply through the basic function of awareness itself. And this is an opportunity that we have to become more aware of every time we sit down to meditate, every time we walk to the subway, every time we sit at the kitchen table, every time we are confronted with a task that brings up aversion, right? So in a sense, I think we're talking about relationship, right? How are we relating to experience? So I think I'll pause here. And we do have some time, which I think is good, and we can we can talk a little bit about this idea of clear seeing, how it is that the way we relate to something affects our experience of it. And because we have some experience in the Dhamma, how all of this impacts directly our experience of self, who we are, what we are, at a very ultimate level, right? The nature of the self. I think the ultimate question here is, what is the true nature of the self? Particularly if it can both suffer and be free within moments of one another, right? What is the insight to be found within that reality, within that truth?